Everyone this morning, especially visitors that we have, we're always glad to have you. Remember that if you have any questions or comments about what we do or why we do it, you have a right to ask and demand book, chapter, and verse. We're happy to make the best attempt that we can to justify ourselves through the Word and not through our own thinking or wisdom. We're very glad to have you, and we want you to come back. Now, I want to start off by reading James chapter 3 and verses 1 through 5 again. Good job was done a while ago, but we want to keep it fresh in our minds as it's kind of a suggestion for the lesson. This is a continuation of the series on James, which involves expository preaching, that is, verse by verse. It says, "There be not many of you teachers, my brethren, knowing that ye shall receive the heavier judgment." The King James Version says, "the weightier condemnation. For in many things we all stumble. If any stumbleth not in word, the same is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body also." Now, if we put the horses' bridles into their mouths, that they may obey us, we turn about their whole body also. Behold, the ships also, though they are so great, and are driven by rough winds, and are yet turned about by a very small rudder, whither the impulse of the steersman willeth. So the tongue also is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold how much wood is kindled by how small a fire. And a little bit of difference in the reading, but the difference is just basically in the translation, as you can see. And it's almost the difference in tomato and tomato. So it's interesting to see what it says. It begins by saying something that's really strange. And that is, "Be not many of you teachers, knowing that we shall receive the heavier judgment." We need teachers. We need people who will give themselves to teach. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 9 and verses 36 through 38 that there was a shortage of laborers. And he asked the disciples to pray for laborers to come into the harvest. In Mark 16 verses 15 and 16, we find that the task given to the early church was to preach the gospel to the whole creation. We haven't got enough teachers to do that unless everybody works and unless we multiply somewhat. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, the apostle tells Timothy, "And the things which thou hast heard from me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also." Now, the object of Paul there in telling Timothy what he told him is so that he might recruit teachers, teach faithful men so they can be able to teach others also. And yet James says, "Be not many of you teachers." And basically what he's talking about there is the gravity of the endeavor in which they are entering. We are spokesmen for God, according to Romans chapter 10, verses 13 through 15. How shall they believe without hearing? How shall they hear without a preacher? How beautiful are the feet of them that bring glad tidings of good things? Paul asks those questions or makes those remarks. And the idea is to emphasize the need for seriousness as we go about teaching, of being consistent with what we teach and how we live. We must teach the truth. In Matthew chapter 15, verses 13 and 14, Jesus says, "But he answered and said, Every plant which my heavenly Father planted not shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides, and if the blind guide the blind, both shall fall in the pit." Well, as a Christian, we are guides of those who are blind. But what if we're blind too? What if we don't know what we're saying? What if we guide in the wrong way? We could be responsible for the loss of a lot of souls if we're not serious about that endeavor. In Romans chapter 2 and verses 1 through 3, Paul addresses Christian Jews in the city of Rome, and he says, "Wherefore thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself. For thou that judgest dost practice the same things." It's hard for me to say for some reason this morning. "And we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against them that practice such things. And reckonest thou this, O man, who judgest them that practice such things and doeth the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God?" In other words, we need to be sure that our lives are consistent with what we're teaching, because we're going to be judged out of the same standard. And he goes on to talk to the Jewish Christians, and he says that they've been entrusted with the law, and they're supposed to be teachers of the law, but because their lives were inconsistent, the name of God was blasphemed among them. So when he says, be not many of you teachers, he's not saying don't be a teacher. What he is saying is, be serious about it. Take it seriously before you get involved, because you are going to be held responsible for what you do, and in some cases, the outcome of what you do. In James chapter 3 and verse 2, the next verse in our text, James says something that sometimes we disconnect from verse 1. In fact, we have a tendency sometimes to look at verse 1 separate and apart from the rest of James chapter 3. And that's a mistake. Now, there are general applications which we will make. But in James chapter 3 and verse 2, he says, for, after he tells them, don't be many of you teachers, knowing you shall receive the heavier judgment. For, or because, in many things we all stumble. If any stumbleth not in word, the same as a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body also. As we teach, we understand how easy it is for us to make a verbal mistake, even in conversation. A mistake that we can't take back. And so we have to exercise self-control. And especially with reference to our words. I knew a woman one time who said that she had learned how to be perfect in her life. And I said, well, how do you do that? I said, people have been looking for that ever since Jesus died on the cross. How do you do that? She says, well, you have to bridle your tongue first. If you don't stumble in word, then you're a perfect individual, able to hold the, bridle the whole body. So I've decided to work on my tongue. And that way I can learn to be perfect. And she was not very successful, because every time there was a juicy tidbit passed through the ears of the brethren, she'd call me on the phone and tell me all about it, or at least as long as I'd let her talk. Usually it wasn't very long. She's a gossip. And sometimes she didn't speak kindly about people. But who am I to judge her? I can just show her what the Bible says and warn her against her sin in that sense, because we're all guilty of not being able to control our tongue in all things. Teachers must be careful is the point that James is getting after, and sometimes they are not. Being careful of what we say is a sign of spiritual maturity, is what James is trying to say. Perfection, well, not flawlessness, but maturity. You can tell the difference between somebody who has self-control and somebody who doesn't, a lot of times, by the way they talk. And we are to exercise self-control in all things as best we can. Now, from that point, James launches into a discussion of the ethics of speech in verses 3 through 11. And first of all, he talks about illustrations of speech's power. And for instance, in verse 3, he says, now we put the horses' bridles into their mouths that they may obey us. We turn about the whole body also. A good horse weighs a little over 1,200 pounds. And if you got in a fuss with a horse, who do you think is going to win? The horse is going to win if he has the brains to do it. Old cowboy once wrote, if a horse knew how big he was, he'd stomp us all to death. But you put that little piece of metal in his mouth and you can turn him anyway. Well, some horses are what they call barn soured, and they're going to go the way they want to go anyway. But sometimes you can actually use that on a horse to, in fact, most of the time, to turn his whole body, all 1,200 pounds. Compared to the wind and the ship itself, how big is the rudder? Look at verse 4. He says, behold, the ships also, though they are so great and are driven by rough winds, are yet turned about by a very small rudder, whither the impulse of the steersman willeth. I was looking at the back end of the Queen Mary that's docked over in Long Beach. The boat's about 1,000 feet long, and the rudder's about 5 feet long, 5 or 6 feet long. And it controls the direction that ship goes in. It may be bigger than that, but it looked minuscule compared to the rest of the ship. You have to look. You took it out of the water, you have to look for it. And we have all learned this lesson in Arizona, verse 5. He says, so the tongue also is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how much wood is kindled by how small a fire. Do you remember the Chediskai fire and the Rodeo fire? They met and they made the biggest fire in Arizona history, maybe Southwest history, I don't know. Millions of acres were burned. And I remember going up to Overgard and Heber as soon as they let people go up there that didn't live there, because that's where we had summer camp. And it looked like toothpicks sticking out of the ground, black, charred, broken toothpicks, and the ground was just battleship gray all the way as far as you could see. From what? Somebody lit a match. Well, the rodeo fire was started on purpose by a fellow who wanted a job that summer fighting fires. What a maroon. And the other fire, the Chediskai fire, was started by a woman who thought she was lost. Actually, she didn't know which forest road she was on, and so she started a fire as a signal fire. And they showed that on live TV, the helicopter picking her up, and nobody put the fire out. And I forget who was sitting in the living room with me that morning, but I just turned to him and I said, well, we're not having camp this year. We're not? I said, no, that thing's going to burn the camp down. It's going to burn down a whole rim. And it just nearly did. It just nearly did. But they were just started with minuscule fire, not much at all. And yet, it just nearly took the whole world, it seemed like. If you lived up there, you just lost everything. I knew a fellow that had a cabin up in Forest Lakes. It was worth about $500,000. And when the fire got finished with it, it was worth about $0.50. And it was pitiful. Well, your tongue is like that. Don't you see that? That's James's point. If you're familiar with those kinds of things that we've talked about to illustrate the power of the tongue, then you know what the power of the tongue is about. Now, there is good and evil speech, and the power that the tongue exerts can be either good or evil. It can affect the salvation of the world, as we noted from Romans chapter 10 and verse 13 through 15, how beautiful are the feet of them that bring glad tidings of good things. Without those preachers being sent, there's no salvation from the gospel. It's through the gospel that God intends that the world should be saved. Now you look at James chapter 3 and verse 6, and you see the evil, where it says, the tongue is a fire, the world of iniquity among our members is the tongue, which defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the wheel of nature, and is set on fire by hell. Well, the tongue can be used for great destruction, is the point. Verse 8, but the tongue can no man tame. It is a restless evil. It is full of deadly poison. And some of us have experienced the poison. And maybe we've issued a little bit of it. But the tongue is a powerful member that can be used for either one. Now, the difficulty in taming the tongue is discussed beginning in verse 7, where he says, for every kind of beast and birds and creeping things and things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed by mankind. I've seen people with pet pythons that they could wrap around their neck. I wouldn't do that for anything. Because, you know, he might decide it's time for lunch. And guess what you would be? And I've seen people get in cages with lions that were not tamed, but they were just used to them. I've seen other things. I saw a man let a Gila monster lick his nose with his tongue. Listen, he was about 5 feet closer than I ever want to be to a Gila monster. And, no, it's not a Gila monster. It's a Gila monster. But by the time he's finished with you, you'd be lucky to say Gila or monster. But people have tamed those. But they can't tame the tongue. There's always something hiding under the tongue waiting to be said. And it gets said for some reason. And so it says the tongue can no man tame. It is a restless evil. It is full of deadly poison. But with God's help, we can tame the tongue. We can bring the tongue under control. David prayed to God in Psalm 141, verse 3, set a watch, O Jehovah, before my mouth, and keep the door of my lips. You know, when I read that, I wonder if that was when he was being tempted to say something that he shouldn't, or after he said something that he shouldn't. I've said it a lot of times, something similar, after I said something and said, oh boy, I shouldn't have said that. And maybe you've done that too. I think we all have been guilty of that. But what we need to do is we need to be more prayerful in our speech so that we don't say things that we don't mean. In Ephesians chapter, you know what? It's like throwing a rock at somebody. You know, you hit somebody in the head with a rock, and it affects them the rest of their life. If it doesn't knock them cuckoo, it affects their attitude toward you for the rest of your life and their life too. And you can't take that rock back. Did you know that? Can't be done. Well, if you say the wrong words to somebody, speak spotless, you can't take that back either. Well, we need to learn to control our speech. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 29, Paul says, let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, but such as is good for edifying as the need may be, that it may give grace to them that hear. Somebody says, well, that means you have to think about everything you say. Wouldn't that be refreshing? And there's time for a person to express anger. There's time for a person to exhort, whether he's a preacher or a school teacher or a coach or manages a store or something like that. But in that exhorting, you still have to watch what you say, because you answer not just to the person you're talking to, you got to answer to God. And so when he says, let no corrupt speech proceed out of your mouth, you don't have to talk like a sissy all the time. But you have to stay within the rules that God, or the boundaries that God has set. And a lot of people forget about that. Now, this passage here in James should not be James chapter 1 in the outlines that you got. It's chapter nothing, because it's not in there. I noticed that this morning. But it should be James chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, where he says, therewith, that is with the tongue, bless we the Lord and Father, and therewith curse we men. We who are made after the likeness of God, out of the same mouth cometh forth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Doth the fountain send forth from the same opening sweet water and bitter? And can a fig tree, my brethren, yield olives, or a vine figs? Neither can salt water yield sweet. Well, the problem is that sometimes we live pretty good, but we don't talk right. And his response to that is, my brethren, these things ought not so to be. Sometimes we just don't have it right. We need to watch our speech and be more careful than we have been in the past about it, especially when we're talking about the flaws in somebody else's life. Our behavior should be consistent with our calling. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1. Paul says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthily of the calling wherewith you are called. In Philippians 1 and verse 27, he says, only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ. In other words, be consistent with what you espouse or with what you profess. The fact is that it will be, it may not be consistent with our calling, but it will be consistent with our character. And that's the scary thing about it. You go back to James chapter 3, and again, verses 11 and 12, where he says, doth the fountain send forth from the same opening sweet water and bitter? Can a fig tree, my brethren, yield olives, or a vine figs? Neither can salt water yield sweet. In other words, what we do and what we say is a product of what we are inside. It's the same thing as being said in Matthew chapter 12. In Matthew chapter 12 and beginning in verse 33, make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree corrupt and its fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by its fruit, ye offspring of vipers. How can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. So if we don't talk right, we got a heart problem. It's not just our speech. There's something inside that is being reflected. And it may not be a big problem until you begin to consider the consequences of not controlling the tongue. Well, it wouldn't do for us to talk this far about the tongue and not deal with abuses of the tongue, and we'll try to get through these pretty quick. First of all, one abuse of the tongue is crude and vulgar speech. And you look at Ephesians chapter 5, where that is addressed in a very direct way. It says in verse 3, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as become a saint, nor filthiness, nor foolish talking, or jesting which are not befitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this ye know of a surety, that no fornicator nor unclean person hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Be careful what you joke around about. What you joke around about may be the source of somebody's condemnation. When Jesus was carried away by the mob and was taken to the house of the high priest and they were holding his trial, Peter followed afar off. He warmed himself by the fire of the enemies of Jesus. And they came to him one at a time, three of them came to him one at a time and said, we know that you're one of them. The last one said, we know you're one of them because your speech makes you known. How did Peter deny Jesus? How did he prove to those people that he was not a disciple of Jesus? He began to curse and to swear. And if you curse and to swear, if you curse and swear, you're not a disciple of Jesus. What was it? I saw it on a bumper sticker one time. I've seen it in other places. If you were arrested for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? There better be. The life of Christ and the goodness of Christ needs to be seen in our lives as we reflect His goodness. And that does not include vulgar or speech that is not seemly. In Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 2, it says, the tongue of the wise uttereth knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools poureth out folly. So we need to be careful. Another abuse of the tongue is lying. Satan is identified in John chapter 8, verse 44, as the father of all liars. But look at Revelation 21 and verse 8. This is how we read it. Everybody reads it this way. But for the fearful, unbelieving, and abominable, and murderers, and fornicators, and sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars. I've never heard anybody read it any different than that unless they were coached or prompted by my observation. All liars, their part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. It's almost as though God doesn't care really about the fearful, unbelieving, abominable murderers and fornicators and sorcerers and idolaters, but all liars are going to go to hell. Well, of course those other things are true. The problem is there are different ways to lie, and sometimes we convince ourselves that the way that we misrepresent the truth is okay because we don't actually verbalize the lie. All liars. Well, one of the great abuses of the tongue is gossip. Saying things, as one teacher of mine used to say, out of school. You say things out of school. What does that mean? That means it's saying things you shouldn't be saying. In Leviticus chapter 19, verse 16, thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbor. I am Jehovah. It was a great and grievous wrong back then. It's a great and grievous wrong today. And 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 13, it says, concerning young widows, and withal they also learn to be idle, going about from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers also, and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. What's the cure for that? Get married. Well, not necessarily. If you're a young widow, you don't have to get married. But that's one good cure for it, because your new family is going to keep you busy. Sometimes people get idle. And as they get idle, they fall away. Angry words, James chapter 1, and verses 19 and 20, he says, you know this, my beloved brethren, but let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. Be slow to speak, swift to hear, slow to wrath. And sometimes we get that in the reverse order. We get mad before we hear enough to make a judgment, and we shoot off our mouth anyway. So be careful of the words that you say. The slanderer, You look at Proverbs chapter 6, verses 12 through 19, a worthless person, a man of iniquity, is he that walketh about with a perverse mouth, that winketh with his eyes, that speaketh with his feet, that maketh signs with his fingers, and whose heart is perverseness, who deviseth evil continually, who soweth discord. Therefore shall his calamity come suddenly, on a sudden shall he be broken, and that without remedy. Now, notice what he says, continuing. He says, there are six things which Jehovah hateth, yea, seven which are an abomination unto him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood. Now, you think about the hands that shed innocent blood, and first thing you think about is persecution, or murder, or assault, or something like that. But in a figurative sense, hands that shed innocent blood can be the guy that gossips about somebody who's unaware, who doesn't know what's going on. He gets stabbed in the back by his friends, so to speak, or those who should have been his friends. And that happens. And God hates it. He hates any kind of injury rendered upon those who are innocent, who don't deserve it, who are unsuspecting. A heart that deviseth wicked purposes, feet that are swift in running to mischief, a false witness that uttereth lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. When somebody comes to you with a real dainty morsel, or he's real angry or upset about something, you just ask yourself the question, is his telling me this? What's going to be the effect? Is it going to cause a rift between me and the person he's talking about? Is he sowing discord? Or is he asking me to go with him and talk to the individual about the problem? There's your two alternatives. How does God feel about it? He hates it. What is that done with? It's done with the tongue. It's done with our speech. False witnesses, God holds them in disrespect. The sower of discord. You look at 3 John in verses 9 and 10, here's perhaps the king of the sowers of discord. In 3 John, in verse 9, he says, I wrote somewhat unto the church, but Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence among them, receiveth us not. Therefore, if I come, I will bring to remembrance his works which he doeth, prating against us with wicked words, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and them that would, he forbiddeth and casteth them out of the church. Now that word prating, you probably have a translation that's a little bit better. In the early 1900s and the late 1800s, prating was a word that was easily understood, but that's before my time. But it means to bring unjust charges against, malicious gossip, unfounded rumors. And people that do that are numbered with Diotrephes. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 20, there is the slanderer who is a whisperer. He's described as a whisperer. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 20, it means to literally to speak in one's ear in an evil sense, a secret slander, backbiting, according to Thayer and Vine. And then there are the backbiters. That word is used in the New Testament. It means to slander, to speak evil of, to backbite, to talk behind somebody's back. And it's synonymous with a whisper, only it's more open, according to the lexicographers, more open. But I would say that probably means more general. Instead of just to one or two people, it's to one or to a group. But this is what God says about it in Galatians chapter 5. And beginning in verse 12, he says, I would that they that unsettle you would go even beyond circumcision. For ye, brethren, were called for freedom, only use not your freedom for an occasion of the flesh. But through love, be servants one of another. For the whole law is fulfilled in this word, even this, thou shalt love thy neighbors thyself. But if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed of one another. And in some places, in some groups, that's the cause for living, is to see how much they can tear up and destroy somebody else. And somebody has commented one time that's where some people get validation. Well, what does that mean? That's where their self-worth is piled up. And how much damage and how much hurt that can mete out to other people. And don't you be one of those people. In verse 21, he says, envy, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, including the backbiting. He says, and such like, of which I forewarn you, even as I did forewarn you, they who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. You can't go to heaven and be a backbiter or a slanderer of any of the sorts that we talked about. Then there's murmuring. The word murmuring comes from a word that I can't say without giggling a little bit, so I'll let you read it. It means to murmur, to mutter, to grumble, to say anything in a low tone. Have you ever been in a group where somebody didn't like what was going on, or somebody saw an opportunity to kind of make a point, and he kind of says in a real low voice so just people around him can hear what he's saying? There's your murmurer. He's doing it in a very literal sense. I've seen that done. I've seen that done in churches. And there's nothing, even if what the person says is valid, there is nothing good about it. And nothing that God will accept in the man that partakes. It is what caused the people of God to fall in the wilderness, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10. And in Philippians chapter 2 and verses 14 and 15, he says, do all things without murmurings and questioning. Don't be one of these constant complainers, one of these guys that kind of has a little remark to say about everything everybody else says, only doesn't have the guts to say it out loud. That you may become harmless or blameless and harmless children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom ye are seen as lights in the world. The person who's got this constant stream of complaining, it may not be in a public setting where he just says it in a low tone. It may be that he's going house to house. He's held up in contrast to those who are as they should be, who are seen as lights in the world. So don't be guilty. Flattery. Flattery is an abuse of the tongue. And according to Webster, it means to praise too much, untruly or insincerely, as in order to win favor, to try to please or ingratiate oneself with by prayer and or by praise and attention. Paul would not use flattery. Flattery is something that is encouraged in the church growth movement churches. I've talked to you before about the high-touch ministry, where they assign people to go up and touch visitors on the shoulder, the arm, and say, it's so good to have you here today. We're so glad that you're here. And just, now, the problem with it is once you place membership, then they're glad somebody else is here and not you anymore. You see, they got you, they've sold you. Now, David, that's not speaking very well of your brethren. Well, sometimes the brethren don't do right. So Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 5, for neither at any time were we found using words of flattery, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness. If you have a compliment to pay somebody, compliment them. But try to be sincere. Mean it. God's witness, nor are seeking the glory of men, neither from you or from others, that we might have claimed authority as apostles of Christ. So we didn't use flattery. We didn't try to please you particularly. We were trying to please God. And, you know, I want you to know I'm glad to see everybody here. Glad everybody came. Even if you've been here a long time. Even if I've gotten used to you and you've gotten used to me, I'm glad to see you. But I don't think that anytime soon will we assign people to come along and, you know, touch you on the shoulder. You know, why on the shoulder? Why do they call it a high touch? Because that's not threatening. You know, if you touch somebody on the side or something like that, that's considered threatening. They teach you how to touch people. And be wary of things like that because, you know, if you get the feeling that somebody's trying to sell you a car, they're trying to sell you a car, okay? Don't be taken in. Who do we please? Galatians chapter 1 and verse 10. For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men? If I were still pleasing men, I should not be a servant of Christ. Now look at Jude in verse 16. Jude in verse 16, he says, these are murmurers, complainers, walking after their own lust, and their mouth speaking great swelling words. There's your flattery. Showing respect of persons for the sake of advantage. That's that individual kind of in a nutshell. On one side, they murmur and complain. On the other side, oh, they just put on a real good show. So be careful of that. In Matthew chapter 12, in verses 36 and 37, which we referred to a while ago, we didn't read it, but we did refer to it. Matthew chapter 12, in verses 36 and 37, Jesus says, and I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words shalt thou be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. What he's saying is, we will be held responsible for what we say. And so we need to be careful of what we say. We must realize the power of our speech to show the way of righteousness to good works into heaven, or to discourage and to dim the light of Jesus in our lives. We need to realize that. And finally, in Psalm 19 and verse 14, the writer says, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Jehovah, my rock and my redeemer. That should be our prayer every morning when we get up. Is God, help me watch my mouth. Help me say the things I need to say and refrain from saying the things they ought not. Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus? Have you been baptized into his name? In Mark 16, 16, Jesus says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. You need to be baptized, but it has to be an act of faith, of confidence, and trust in the Lord. If you have been baptized, but you haven't been living the way that you should, you need to ask God to forgive you and repent of your sins. And he's promised to do that. And we can help you if you need it in either one of those endeavors. But you have to let us know by coming to the front while we stand and sing.